You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson and this is being recorded the evening of May 21st, 2025. I had a couple of topics that I wanted to deal with today. I wasn't sure which one to do. This one is the one I decided on is American foreign policy with some Chinese emphasis, but the one I may save it for next week is the slaughter of Ukrainian pilots in the air, which is a tragedy just as bad as what's going on, what went on the ground. And don't forget, I have a book coming out on the Russo-Ukrainian war, and I'll keep you updated on that. And some of these, and that's why my other book on China has been put on the back burner. So anyway, the absurdity of American foreign policy and Trump's very inappropriate use of the phrase America first. Here's what Paul Craig Roberts said a couple of weeks ago, May 6th. He said, "The foreign policy of the United States is in the hands of the least capable, most uninformed, and most reckless morons the American education system has yet produced. And their successors, if any, will be worse." We're going to talk about one of those people here in a little bit. But he's, of course, completely correct. Uninformed, reckless, they live in an information bubble. Their world is censored and sanitized, and they simply don't have access to this kind of, you know, any alternative information. It's not in their interest. American aggression. And I said this, I've been saying this for 20 years, that as the American empire gets harder and harder to maintain, as the American economy goes deeper into depression, the regime is going to start lashing out like a wounded animal when you corner it. Some of this lashing out is actually done under the euphemism of national defense or even human rights. Let me quote again from Roberts. He says, "Washington conducted wars against Mexico, the Confederate States of America, the Indians, Spain, from whom Washington seized Cuba in the Philippines, varied Central and South American countries. Remember, U.S. Marine Commander Smedley Butler, twice decorated with America's highest honor, who said that he and his U.S. Marines were the enforcement squad in Latin America for the United Fruit Company and the New York banks, who were exploiting Latin America to the hilt, backed up by the bayonets of the U.S. Marine Corps." Now, I don't want to fall into a crude economism here. Yes, economic factors are very, very important. But you have to think systematically. You know, a realist thinks systematically. A nominalist can't, because there is no system. But as the U.S. got more aggressive, the Secretary of War became Secretary of Defense. I mean, how many examples can you offer? Many of which were not successful. Korea, Vietnam, all over the Caribbean. And he cites in Africa, leaders and governments were overthrown. Yugoslavia. I assume he means in the 90s. In the Middle East, where Washington eliminated Israel's opponents for no American interests whatsoever. Then the Georgian case against Russia, and of course today, the case in Ukraine. And of course, there are thousands of others. Worse, the U.S. has what he calls pending wars. against Iran and China, while continuing the one against Russia. Now, this is supposed to happen by shifting the burden of war to NATO, or the European members of NATO. Now, I've gone through this before, but the European members of NATO have very little in terms of military hardware. There is no, they have no army of any size. You know, the British have had this, you know, the smallest military they've had in 400 years, and it's shrinking. They've given what little they have to the Ukrainians, where it was immediately destroyed. But in no way can any of this be called national defense or human rights. It's just a matter of global hegemony, especially from a weakening empire. And as the empire gets weaker, you start to hear more bluster and the use of proxies and mercenaries rather than any kind of direct action. Robert says that Washington negotiates with its enemies, enemies that it's created. You know, Russia, China, Iran, they've done nothing against the West or the U.S. So they've constructed this enemy in their minds. And there's an entire school of thought of constructivism and foreign policy, and that's certainly relevant here. And that's why this level of ignorance is so important for leading circles. But any kind of negotiation exists for only one purpose, to present them with peace agreements that they could never accept. The only reason that they offer these impossible agreements is so later on they could claim that they sought peace, but peace was refused. Let me quote him directly again, and this is very worthwhile. Talking about the negotiating strategy and what they are trying to impose on their constructed enemies. They have to conform their policies to Washington's instructions. Iran has to dismantle its national defense and destroy its conventional missiles. Iran can't sell any oil to China or anyone else. Iran can't enrich uranium for peaceful purposes. Russia can't have all of its conquests in the Russian territories in Ukraine. Ukraine won't be demilitarized. Russia will be punished, that's SIC, with more sanctions if Putin doesn't agree to a ceasefire before he even knows what the deal is. Ukraine can have de facto NATO membership with mutual security clause with the West. China can't continue succeeding economically, certainly not more than America. And far from renouncing the Paul Wolfowitz doctrine of American hegemony, President Trump espouses it. There is nothing America first about Donald Trump's foreign policy, at least in his second term. America first was to withdraw from the global stage, become as self-sufficient as possible. There would be no reason to have enemies in that case. But, as I've said a million times, the U.S. is not as strong as these very isolated people think. And not just militarily, but emotionally, spiritually, financially. And he notes that you can't have generations of denouncing Western civilization, every university campus, creating the white male uncertainty. The white male, of course, is the core of everything. Creating their uncertainty, no sense of identity. And the damage they've done mentally is extensive. So you have these coming wars with China, Iran, Russia, whoever. What exactly are these young men dying for? And it will only be men, except Israel and the prophets of the regime. Why should any American die for this? Of course, the question isn't asked, let alone answered. Now, many of you may not remember the Wolfowitz Doctrine. This came out in the Bush administration, but it wasn't really put to paper until maybe halfway through. And here's what he says. This is the doctrine itself. Now, keep in mind that what I'm going to quote here is the secret doctrine that wasn't meant to be published. It was leaked. It has been rewritten for public consumption, but I'm not even going to worry about that. This was just for neocon eyes only. Our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival, either on the territory of the former Soviet Union or elsewhere, that poses a threat on the order of that posed formerly by the Soviet Union. This is a dominant consideration underlying the new regional defense strategy and requires that we endeavor to prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would, under consolidated control, be sufficient to generate global power. Now, this has, of course, been de facto official policy, and it doesn't matter who the president is. This is far deeper than politicians. Now, this was written a long time ago. Russia is explicitly mentioned as a possible opponent, but he refers to Russian nationalism specifically as the what is to be opposed. And that became official doctrine too. Now, Wolfowitz doesn't care and never cared about the Soviet threat except as they armed Iraq and Syria against Israel. It had nothing to do with the USA. But the broader point is the resources to buttress the American economy have to be kept under American hands, despite the fact that no hostile power has ever sought to keep them from the American market. If you remember, in the early 90s, well, even before Desert Shield was launched, the claim was that Saddam Hussein, if he takes the oil-producing regions of Kuwait and even Saudi Arabia, will not sell that to the U.S., will starve the Americans, which was an incredibly stupid thing. It would be the last thing he would do. The one thing they will do, any of them, is to sell to whoever they need to. Back in the early 90s, the U.S. did get some oil from that part of the world. They don't. The U.S. doesn't anymore. Let me continue here. The U.S. must show the leadership necessary to establish and protect a new order that holds the promise of convincing potential competitors that they need not aspire to a greater role or pursue a more aggressive posture to protect their legitimate interests. In non-defense areas, we must account sufficiently for the interests of the advanced industrial nations to discourage them from challenging our leadership or seeking to overturn the established political and economic order. We must maintain the mechanism for deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role. Well, this goes back to the 1990s. That's a very odd passage, what I just wrote here. Who is he talking about? This vague advanced industrial nations. Is he talking about the European Union or the EC? Well, whatever it is, the competitor has to be destroyed. The U.S. military was a very different animal in 1994 than it is today. I've dealt with that issue many, many times. But ideology, as I've mentioned with Paul Craig Roberts, is also very important. The belief system forced throughout the Western world, decades of white liberal and Jewish propaganda that the Western world, prior to its own rule, is racist and homophobic, whatever. And the only way to make amends for this is for whites to accept second-class citizenship. That is what they mean by the Trump deplorables, which is a ethnic and gender class. And he quotes Jean Raspail's novel, The Camp of the Saints, which was eliminated only because it lost belief in itself. The regime is quite aware of psychology and ideology in all of this. The proof is the high level of white male suicide and the refusal of high-functioning whites to reproduce. Obviously, there's a connection. A white American can never believe in himself when he's told that he is the source of all evil, all oppression. This is indoctrination, and it starts early. So the point he's trying to make is that could the propagandists in Washington create worse monsters out of Putin or Xi or anyone else that the university have created out of white people? What exactly would the military be fighting for? And it could only really be liberalism itself, both economic and political. So on the one hand, the neocons, heavily Jewish, basically liberal in everything, they're leftists, they tell Americans that they're ordained for global rule. On the other hand, their Jewish friends tell Americans that they're hopeless, that they're racists who have to be displaced and replaced. people my age sometimes forget that the left is the war party now. They benefit from these wars far more than anybody else. The neocons, being Jewish, are not white. Whites are just cannon fodder, kind of like Ukrainians are. But the Trump regime is creating a war scenario that the U.S. cannot win. Now, I have lectured on that until I'm blue in the face. But here's, Paul Craig Roberts speculates here. Let me quote him. Let's just consider one of the many possible developments. Washington withdraws from the war in Ukraine, leaving it to Europe. But before Washington can engage China, Netanyahu sends his American puppet against Iran. Iran, unlike Putin, decides to fight. There go the American aircraft carriers in the region. There go the American bases in the Middle East. Iran's Russian supplied air defense systems eliminate a huge percentage of the Air Force, of the USAF. The U.S. is handed a resounding military defeat, so out come the nuclear weapons. Well, I've said many times how extremely vulnerable the American bases in those areas are, and now that the Russians and the Chinese are far ahead of Washington in hypersonic missile technology, the Patriot batteries, even though there's a tremendous shortage of them, can't do much about it. Russia stands alone against the West. The ultimate goal, of course, is to finish Russia off by breaking it into a bunch of smaller countries and territories, like the Soviet Union, and creating Ukraine for the first time in history. This large independent state, sort of independent state, now only 30 years old, entirely a creation of Washington and a failed creation of Washington. Putin has to understand that the peace negotiations, which I haven't really been following, are fraud. They're designed to fail. I don't care what the media says about it. It seems that these wars are being done in sequence. Certainly, the U.S. lacks the strength to take on all of its opponents that it invents simultaneously. I don't think it has the strength to deal with them one-on-one either. So Zelensky or Putin can never accept the terms that Donald Trump offers. Trump can extract the U.S. from the conflict. He could just simply walk away. NATO, you know, doesn't have the material, doesn't have the equipment or the men for any action. And of course, so none of that makes any sense. This is all based on the same information bubble. They believe that Europe is this powerhouse, and it simply isn't. As far as Iran goes, the demands that the Trump administration makes in Iran are absurd. They can't be taken seriously. It comes down to stripping them of all sovereignty, which makes sense. He even said that the U.S. sanctions every country that buys oil from Iran, of course, is mindless, probably impossible. And further, sanctions have been a boon to many of the countries that have suffered under them. He says that Washington is trying to cut China off from oil like FDR did Japan, just leading to the very war that FDR wanted. But as I've been saying, even since the 90s, in the early 2000s, what has Russia done? How is Russia endangering anybody? It has threatened no Western country. And the only thing it's done is plead for basic security agreements with the West, which were made in the 90s, which were all reneged, which were all eliminated, but they've been refused anyway. Iran's the same way. What have they done? Absolutely nothing against the West. Yet somehow we're supposed to accept Mossad and CIA mass murder of scientists in Iran. Iran's in the crosshairs because Iran supports Israel's opponents, whether it be the Houthis in Yemen or Hezbollah. Washington has spent a fortune eliminating any powerful figure in the Arab world, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Sudan. And in fact, Robert says the Arab world doesn't exist anymore. It's been wiped out for the sake of the Jews at the cost of millions of lives. And it continues. Norman Podhoretz made clear in Commentary, a Jewish journal, simply stating it outwardly, the whole purpose of the U.S., the whole purpose of the U.S. presence in the Mideast is to destroy any Arab resistance, any Arab government that stands in the way of greater Israel. And it's not just that the state of Washington complied, but so did its media, so did its corporations. There is no functional government in Libya. There's no functional government in Syria. There certainly isn't one in Iraq. It's a series of fiefdoms. Saudi Arabia is probably all that's left. And he points out that a good chunk of Saudi Arabia has already been added to the map of Greater Israel. Israel announced already that its conquest, full conquest of Palestine and the population of Palestine is underway. U.S. has destroyed for Israel anything that's gotten in its way. Millions have been killed, starved, murdered, whatever, towards this end. Now, I want to talk about someone named Elbridge Colby. Now, I came across this guy reading Mike Whitney. In an article he wrote, I found it in Global Research, May 4th of this year. I like Mike, but there are certain things that I disagree with him on. But I'm really glad he brought this guy. With Elbridge Colby, you already kind of know what he looks like just by the name. Now, the tariff nonsense, you know, he's backed down on it. The only purpose is to, you know, they still don't think that China is the predominant power in Asia. It has been for some time. The trade war, the tariff war, is just another way of prosecuting a military operation, just by different means. Encircling China with more military bases and overthrowing pro-Chinese governments everywhere. Elbridge Colby is someone who I hadn't heard of prior to this article. He is Undersecretary for Defense for Policy. This is a Pentagon position that creates the overall defense initiative, the basic concept. Now, he's very typical. He's not a political scientist. He's a Yale lawyer that immediately upon graduation was granted very high positions in the state apparatus without any knowledge of it. That suggests that he's been initiated, secret society connections. He was granted these positions, especially of a military nature, despite having no knowledge of military policy or history or any understanding of the Asian universe. How do you go from Yale Law School to the Department of Defense, the Department of State, all the intelligence, the entire intelligence world, even serving the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq in 2003? Did he just pick up on the knowledge along the way? Did he ever function as a lawyer at all? What was he doing at Yale, really? This is where the elites are taken from. People like me come out of the state universities. We're of a very different kind. I got initiated into nothing. The Ivy Leagues are a very different story because they've been penetrated by the regime intelligence for a very long time. Somehow this guy, going from position to position like this, right after, you know, he was the office of the Director of National Intelligence from 2005 to 2006. He has no background or knowledge of intelligence, but he is initiated. The man wrote nothing of value prior to this. He never accomplished anything of value when he was granted these positions. The only thing that matters is that he is a trusted friend of the system. Now, if you look the guy up, he looks like every 1980s movie WASP bad guy that gets his comeuppance at the end. The fact that his name is Elbridge, you know, it's almost like we're making him up. Now, Whitney is wrong to say that he is not a neocon. He is. But he is of a very different type. He was a fellow at the Project for the New American Century. The only problem is his focus is not on Israel. Now, his appointment had to go through the Senate, and it was challenged only because he wasn't willing to attack Iran. He doesn't see Iran as a serious threat. And he's absolutely right. That's interesting. He recognizes that the U.S. is highly limited, but he wants everything then to be focused on China. But he wasn't attacked in the Senate because he wasn't a neocon. It was just because he wasn't an Israel firster. He most certainly is a neocon, though, but he's also a Gentile. He's written a whole bunch of articles, written in layman's language, featured in mainstream media, Time magazine, all of this, you know, suggesting an initiation into the regime at a fairly young age. The only thing interesting about him is his desire to disengage from the Mideast, to disengage, at least in part, in Ukraine and focus exclusively on China. Now, why is a separate issue. That may be his role in all of this. But he does nothing more than repeat the slogans that he's been told, that there's not a syllable out of his mouth that's original. China is a threat to the rules-based international order, if you can believe that. Now, in 2018, he was in Trump's first term as well. He, without any background or knowledge, is writing a national defense strategy, or at least influencing one. Western elites certainly are worried about China, and the neocons seem to have different emphases depending on who they are. Jews focus on Israel, some of the Gentiles not so much. Let me quote from this very concept. It reads, China and Russia are now undermining the international order from within the system by exploiting its benefits while simultaneously undercutting its principles and rules of the road. Well, there are a few problems with that. Russia is not a member of the international order due to sanctions, so you really must be talking about China. Rules-based. The U.S. follows no rules. It reneges on all treaties. The EU is trying to steal billions in Russian investments in the West. Arms control treaties just pulled out of. It can't be trusted at any level whatsoever. So I don't know what he means. He means American rule. When I say he, I'm talking about the national defense concept here. It reads, China is leveraging military modernization, influence, and predatory economics to coerce neighboring countries to reorder the Indo-Pacific region to their advantage. Well, the problem there is that the U.S. can't keep up. China is Asia's number one trade partner. The U.S. couldn't keep up if it wants to. Then it says, the central challenge to U.S. prosperity and security is a reemergence of long-term strategic competition by what the national security strategy classifies as revisionist powers. It's increasingly clear that China and Russia want to shape a world consistent with their authoritarian model, gaining veto authority over other nations' economic, diplomatic, and security decisions. Well, that just means that the regime can't rule the world absolutely. That's what authoritarianism means, that American capitalists will be on a tight leash, at least in these parts of the world. That's what revisionism is. Now, Colby had a lot of influence on the national defense strategy. And Whitney says that it's the end of the war on terror and the beginning of the great power competition in the East. The U.S. has to, maybe this is subconscious, realizes it simply doesn't have the money or the men or the materiel or even the confidence to have a multi-front war, shifting everything to the Indo-Pacific, which is you know, we've talked about how impossible it is for the American Navy to supply that region in case of a war. And they're talking about conventional weapons, the older style warfare, combat troops, industrial capacity. Yeah, they're going to use covert action and guerrilla warfare and everything else. But they're talking about a conventional war with China as if the American merchant fleet can supply the U.S. over there. We've been through that 1,000 times. The U.S. doesn't have that capacity. It can't create a supply chain. So Whitney says that war seems to be returning to its original form. simply the clash of armies and navies of states. Now, it's very odd to hear him say that his main objective is to prevent China from emerging as Asia's regional hegemon. Well, it's a little late for that. Where's this guy been? So what he wants to do is build more bases, surround China with even more weaponry, overthrow governments, you know, to create anti-China coalitions, and of course, purge the Pentagon. It says a reformed Pentagon capable of responding quickly to developments in Asia. So you're talking about color revolutions on the one side and purging the Pentagon on the other. More bases just means more provocation, spending money that the U.S. simply doesn't have. The U.S. can't do it, even if it wanted to. It seems that Colby doesn't have the capacity to see that this is provocative. He doesn't think it is. Given the company he keeps and the Ivy League mentality, the country club mentality he has, he's incapable of seeing beyond that. He can't think systematically. He hasn't been trained in any of these fields. He was a Yale lawyer. Immediately shuffled off to these positions at the State Department. Again, I guess it's a learning along the way. He acts like it's 1991. He wrote a book in 2021 called The Strategy of Denial. Pretty much the same thing. There's nothing original in it. Because he seems to think that so long as the U.S. pulls away from everything else, which I don't know how he's going to do that, concentrating on China could mean that a war can be won, a regular conventional war can be won against the Chinese. Explicitly saying that any attempt to break Washington's encirclement by force will result in unacceptable losses. That is, as Whitney says, the de facto policy of the Trump administration. But it's the U.S. who has that problem, not the Chinese. These guys have no conception. Because of the company they keep, the people who they talk to every day, they don't know this stuff. I hope to God that the FBI is listening to what I'm saying. It would be the only education they would ever get. The U.S. simply, physically, can't wage war overseas. She does not have the supply capacity. It doesn't have the men. It doesn't have the workable naval assets. U.S. bases can be wiped out very quickly. Because Russia and China are ahead on missile technology. Does he really not know that? I'm willing to bet that he simply doesn't. That's why I started off with the Paul Craig Roberts idea that foreign policy is in the hands of ignoramuses. The guy even says that this isn't about starting a war, it's about avoiding one. He has no conception of consequences. I mean, the guy's been given everything. He wrote in Foreign Affairs, "The goal is not to fight a war, but to deter one by making clear to Beijing that it cannot succeed in its aggressive aims, particularly against Taiwan or other key allies." Aggressive aims. He just admitted that the U.S. is encircling China. The U.S. has no right to be over there, right in its own territory. He says Taiwan is the linchpin of the first island chain, and its fall to China would fundamentally undermine the U.S. strategic position in Asia, emboldening Beijing and weakening our alliances. That's from that same book. The island chain theory is, you know, very abstract. Just as a matter of concentric circles away from Taiwan being in the nearest one and then going out to, you know, as far away as Guam. But China is the dominant trade partner with Taiwan. I've already been through that. He says, defending Taiwan is not about sentimentality. Well, who's ever said it was about sentimentality? But about hard-nosed strategic interests. If China controls Taiwan, it will dominate the Western Pacific, threatening Japan, the Philippines, and our credibility. I guess American bluster is sufficient to win a war. I'm not sure how taking Taiwan would be the object that would lead to threatening everything else. I don't know what the connection would be. The two countries are deeply intertwined as it is. But the U.S. already has stated that Taiwan is legally a part of China. It can't have it both ways. We've spoken about it on this show many times. Conducting naval drills in the Taiwan Strait, South China Sea. Again, the U.S. has no right to be there. Taking over the press in Taiwan, manipulating opinion. But I guess that's the plan. It's based on these men living in an informational bubble, where inconvenient facts are censored and the rest are simply sanitized. The U.S., the policy is basically using intelligence agencies from around the world, the NGOs, to manipulate public opinion in Taiwan. The U.S. is already arming Taiwan. The U.S. is not stronger than the Chinese, and certainly not in its own backyard. The concept of building even more military bases, despite not having any money, the color revolution, you know, the U.S. makes itself this nuisance. Pulling countries away from China would impoverish them. But worse, the U.S. is critically short of ammunition and weapons platforms. Most of its navy is not combat ready. I've been through this already. From NATO documents, at best, the Air Force is at 50% capacity with a massive pilot shortage. The U.S. is a violent imperial power, but it just can't maintain anything. So there's nothing restrained. This is where Whitney is wrong. There's nothing restrained about Colby's rhetoric at all. It comes from a complete lack of knowledge or understanding. Knowledge is not important, which is why he could go from law school to these very sensitive positions with nothing in between. Donald Trump does regard China as America's primary strategic enemy. And, you know, both China and Colby and everyone else want to enhance the military deterrence. China has to be treated with an iron fist, despite the fact that the U.S. has no iron. What it all comes down to is creating an incident, a false flag, triggering an incident that will be used as a pretext for war. China's position has always been to engage the U.S. diplomatically. That's always been its concern. But that's not necessarily an option. The administration, it was no different than Biden or anyone else. It's all the same group of people controlling foreign policy. Neocons and weirdo militarists, they're no real diplomats. But as far as manipulating Taiwanese opinion, now this goes back a few years. There was a phone survey in 2019 conducted in 9 major cities on the island. This is in China, this is in the PRC, not the ROC. Okay. 2019 phone survey, a majority of Chinese supported using military force for unification with Taiwan. The percentage that wouldn't support that is 39%. And when you look at these polls from 2020, 2021, it's always at least 55% of the respondents accept launching a war to unify with Taiwan entirely, and roughly in the 30s% opposed. Only 22% in China accepted the notion of both sides keeping their present political systems. September 2024 poll by the Carter Center, Emory University. 55% of mainland Chinese respondents agreed with the statement that the Taiwan problem should not be resolved using force under any circumstances. As far as Taiwan goes, more than 80% of them are in favor of keeping things the way they are. No independence, maintaining two systems. So it's extremely difficult to tell, especially in mainland China. I've just quoted very, very different statistics here. I don't know where these cities took place. The first one was on, 9 major Chinese cities. I'm not sure about elsewhere. I don't know what those cities were. But this is absolutely connected with the tariff policy. Remember, it was April 2nd. Donald Trump had two legitimate aims for these. Terrorists, I never had a problem with terrorists whatsoever. But the point was to, the short-term goal was to reduce trade deficits, which are massive at this point. The long-term is to bring these manufacturing centers back to the U.S. Now, they were stated goals. I have no problem with either one of them. There's nothing good about free trade. Free trade could be used in very limited circumstances. But what was the real aim? It was the same thing. It was to weaken China, to prevent it selling goods to American customers, providing incentives. The U.S. simply doesn't have this, but incentives to the nations that want to reduce their trade with the Chinese, which would be very difficult to do, since even the U.S. allies in the area, China, are very dependent on the Chinese. That was the point of the tariff war, though. The Chinese have overtaken the U.S. in almost every area of industrial and technological production. That debate is over. It's certainly the number one economy in the world. But almost all of Asia lists China as its primary trade partner, including Taiwan. I'm not sure how this is ever going to be done. It's a little late for a lot of this stuff. China is one of Taiwan's most important targets for foreign investment. From 91 to 2022, $200 billion have been invested in China by Taiwanese companies. And a lot of this, by the way, not entirely legally. Technically, this kind of trade was illegal, but it happened anyway. In fact, before 2016, it was half of Taiwan's foreign direct investment. A lot of Taiwanese-owned manufacturing, electronics, etc., is in China. These investments did help, of course, Taiwan, but also helped in China's economic rise, too. China is Taiwan's largest trading partner, 20% of total trade. If you add Hong Kong, it's another 30%. Of Taiwan's exports. Taiwan even has a trade surplus with mainland China and Hong Kong, about $100 billion. But trade was only officially permitted in 2021, from 2009 to 2021, but it was going on anyway. It simply didn't matter what the law stated. They're Chinese. I remember reading about this in grad school. That technically they're not supposed to be trading with each other, and yet the trade between the two countries and investment are in the tens of billions of dollars at least. They just went along with the fait accompli at that point. Taiwan's economy is dependent on international trade. It's tiny. Now the regime says that despite its economic role, over reliance on this trade poses national concerns, because it is dependent on China. Therefore, because the U.S. can't see any other relationship, it therefore makes it vulnerable to Chinese pressure, because that's how the U.S. operates. Now, this is why the regime wants Taiwan to decouple from China, to remove themselves from China and move to the U.S., Japan, Australia. And they think in such simple terms. If this were done, Taiwan would become impoverished. Her lifeline is her Asian trade. I mentioned on this show before that the American market is a fairly small percentage of Chinese exports. It's not like it used to be. People are hanging on to these myths and stories. I'm going to quote Mike Whitney here. He says, "Fortunately, Trump's tariff plan failed, and he was forced to ease the tariffs without achieving any of his main objectives. The reason we say fortunately is because the tariff policy never served the interests of the American people. Quite the contrary, Americans are hurt by the unilateral policies that ignore the rules of international trade and needlessly disrupt supply chains. All it does is push prices higher, reduce unemployment, and slow growth. Besides, manipulating tariffs with the intention of destroying a rival violates a number of widely accepted rules that protect the interests of everyone." So all of a sudden, Mike Whitney starts talking like a university economist. None of that is true. He seems to believe that there'd be empty shelves because of these tariffs. There is nothing good about the structure of international trade. The U.S. has the ability to be entirely self-sufficient. The U.S. doesn't care about rules. It never has. When you have an oligarchy that's completely globalized, policies that would make sense in a market economy make no sense in a globalized oligarchy. Who cares about what the WTO says? Who cares what GATT says? And since when does Mike Whitney care about that stuff? He's been a dissenting author for a long time, but now he's talking like this. Well, he's right when he says that China acted in a very different kind of a way. They realized that the U.S. is far more dependent on China than China is dependent on the U.S. They refused to give in. Now China will talk about the rules of GATT and the WTO. That's just rhetoric. It doesn't matter. But if your tariff goes up to 200%, that's essentially an embargo. But what does the U.S. care about that? The U.S. created these rules, and they'll break them the moment that it doesn't work. It doesn't serve their interests. Who cares if Trump showed his contempt for the international system? Who gives a damn? That's a good thing. So Mike Whitney is talking like a different author all of a sudden here. But this is what the Chinese newspaper, the Global Times, says. The multilateral trading system of the WTO, at its core, is a cornerstone of international trade and plays an important role in global economic governance. All parties should resolve differences and disputes through equal-footed dialogue under the framework of the WTO, jointly uphold multilateralism and free trade, and promote the stability and smooth functioning of global industrial and supply chains. Well, the dominant country certainly is in a position to say that. The weaker country certainly cannot. Claiming that Trump's loss was a victory for the system of international trade, that's a bad thing. But it certainly also was a victory for China. It refused to bow. The U.S. had to back down. These dramatic reductions that Trump had to engage in the executive order exceeded the Chinese expectations. The dollar and the stock market went up, as if that has anything to do with the typical American. Chinese equity surged, and it met all of China's demands. Even the 34% tariff from April 2nd has been suspended. The normal rate is 10%. It applies everywhere. This is way beyond Chinese expectations. The U.S. backed down. I don't have to argue this point anymore. They have the leverage that the U.S. doesn't have. Now, why Whitney is talking about the sanctity of free trade and all this is utter nonsense. U.S. policy towards China is immoral, is counterproductive, because it's demanding a war that would slaughter God knows how many people. But these very impulsive tactics hurt the Trump presidency. And he uses a metaphor, something like I've used before. I've used a few metaphors for this. An enfeebled prize fighter entered the ring with a ferocious young contender who pummeled him in the first round. Now, I've used a million metaphors like that. You know, Monty Burns, when he loses a nuclear plant, has no money. But it's more than just the enfeebled prize fighter, the arrogant enfeebled, the prize fighter who thinks that he's at the top of his game and gets beaten up. China made zero concessions to the U.S. Whitney also seems to think that if there's a 1% tariff increase, that's a 1% increase in the price of something. These are mostly American companies that could easily adjust their price anyway. How Donald Trump is claiming that this is a victory. But, you know, financial markets are based on oligarchy. Of course, they're going to be volatile when any kind of national tariff or import substitution is promoted. That means absolutely nothing. The value of securities is wildly inflated regardless. And has nothing to do with the value of the underlying securities, if they even talk about the underlying securities. The regime was trying to talk about empty shells and data showing shipments into the U.S. collapsing. Absolute nonsense. Nothing like that ever happened. Remember, during COVID, the regime was telling us the dead bodies piling up all over the place. Hospitals are overrun. That was never the case. Nothing they said was ever the case there. It isn't so much that, you know, the left loves that Donald Trump has been defeated here, but that's irrelevant. What really matters is that the U.S. has been defeated. It doesn't have this leverage. But it doesn't matter, though, because no one in the financial press or the academics or anything else will ever adjust their opinions here. China is the dominant industrial power in the world. The U.S. is not. Donald Trump has always overestimated the size of the American market, which is so indebted to begin with. I think the Chinese share is 15%, or 15% of China's exports goes to the U.S. Now, the stated goals, I have no problem with the stated goals. But the real goal, weakening or isolating China, has failed miserably. And there's three reasons why, and I've been saying this for God knows how long. China doesn't need the U.S. They've been diversifying for a very long time, in large part because of Russian sanctions. There's a lot of other buyers. People think that Chinese are all poor? They must think that. They still think China's the third world in the Ivy League. The state reacted because the state is more powerful than capital in China and Russia. They simply were able to intervene quickly. And there was a threat of withholding certain exports. Again, even threatening American companies in so doing. But I'm not sure, what does Mike Whitney think if he really believes in eliminating or lessening trade deficits and bringing industrial jobs back home to the U.S.? How else besides tariffs would he do that? There is no plan without tariffs. So this is always a complicated issue. It's not a one-liner kind of matter. The equities market skyrocketing after the settlement was announced. It's nonsense. That has nothing to do with the underlying securities. This is how oligarchs, the very same people who run these companies, who are making American foreign policy, it doesn't matter. Because Donald Trump overestimated, as I've been saying for years, the American position in the world and Chinese strength, he never anticipated China's response. Again, the information bubble. They really believe that China is a third world country that would fall apart given these threats. They can't access the American market anymore. Whitney says this, but who's been saying this for a decade and a half? Scott Bessent, Secretary of the Treasury, again, someone who has no knowledge of any of this stuff. Here's what he said. He said this on CNBC. We, meaning the U.S., are a deficit country. I think he means debtor country. They sell almost five times more goods to us than we sell to them. So the onus would be on them to take off these tariffs. Those tariffs are unsustainable for them. He cited estimates that China could lose 5 to 10 million jobs if tariffs persist, highlighting China's economic vulnerability. This man has no right to be Secretary of the Treasury or anything else. What kind of argument is that because we're the junior partner, therefore we have all the leverage? The U.S. is $36 trillion per year in debt. How does being broke give anyone the advantage? Somehow, the Secretary of the Treasury believes that being destitute and broken gives the U.S. the upper hand? Are you kidding me? It's the same thing with everyone I've been talking about on here. Knowledge is not relevant. Bessent, of course, like all these guys, are wrong about everything. It won't affect his reputation or his job or anything about that. Now, I think what he's trying to say, given the alleged strength of the American market, China really needs that market. And if Americans don't buy from China, the Chinese economy will suffer. I think that's kind of what he means. But it didn't work out that way. Again, that's a very simplistic understanding of this. If markets actually worked, it would be one thing, but they don't. It's not just an oligarchy, which is not has nothing to do with the market, but a globalized one. So it's not just that, you know, China's this aggressor, which is this pure projection. It has to be. But that China is very weak. It's third world. It's still, you know, this is 1960. See, in a globalized oligarchy, none of the normal parameters of economics stand. You can't talk about how a market will respond when there's no markets. A consortium of banks and cartels set prices. And Chinese companies are a part of this, since so many of them are American regardless. So you can't use market metaphors when you're talking about any of this stuff. China is not the American enemy by any means. They don't want a confrontation with the U.S. Why would they? So there were the meetings in Switzerland not that long ago. And in fact, it even was Scott Bessent, another aide, said, well, you know, we may have to back down on these tariffs after talking the way he did. Now, this was stuff from the Washington Post, which may or may not be true. So he went to Geneva and really capitulated. The fear was that, well, Trump's supporters would be hurt by this, again, given the very simplistic understanding of international trade. And the fact that these tariffs have gone up and down, they've been revised so many times. Again, according to the Washington Post, this doesn't look very good either. He's reversed himself in many types of tariffs: auto, steel, aluminum, agriculture, energy. So the 145% is history. And of course, China did the same, but only after that. So I'm not entirely sure how Trump considered this a victory. He said, and this is actually his spokesman, Kush Desai, said, the only special interest guiding President Trump's decision-making is the best interest of the American people. The administration's Geneva Agreement with China stabilizes our trade relationship while setting the stage for a comprehensive trade deal that will put Americans in America first. It isn't like his specific agenda is incorrect. His information is completely wrong. If his true goals are to, you know, reduce the deficit and bring manufacturing to the U.S., I have no problem with that. But he somehow is under the impression that China is this terrible aggressor. But how in heaven's name does Donald Trump use the slogan America First? America First was the exact opposite of this policy. It wasn't having new bases all over the planet, but dismantling them. That slogan is comically inappropriate in this context. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.